Welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis and want to improve your game, this podcast is for you. Whether it's technique, strategy, equipment, or the mental game, tennis professional Ian Westerman is here to make you a better player. And now, here's Ian.
Hi, and welcome to episode number 14 of the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis and you have a passion for it, and if you want to improve your game, this is the place for you to be. Thanks very much for taking the time to download this file and taking the time to listen. My hope is that your time will be well spent, and through the good instruction and information that you'll receive listening to this podcast, you too can improve your tennis game. That's my goal for you. Two quick things here before we get to the content for today's show. First of all, I would just like to announce the Essential Tennis Forum on EssentialTennis.com. I also mentioned this during my quick midweek podcast a couple days ago, and I just wanted to repeat quickly that the forum is up on EssentialTennis.com, and several people have already signed up, and we're getting some great conversations and discussions going there about tennis. Lots of different topics for you guys to go in and participate in, and my hope is that it continues to grow and it becomes a great, you know, close community of people who love tennis. So if you love tennis, head on over there. I hope that you find it useful and fun as well, and I want it to continue to grow. So I have a special offer for you guys just for this week. If you go over to the forum and register, if you're one of the first three people to post in the topic, why do you love tennis, you will be eligible for a free set of strains. Right now, I'm the only one who has a post in that forum. If you sign up for the forum, or if you're already signed up, if you're one of the next three people to post a message under why do you love tennis, and just take that post and put it in an email and send it to me along with your name and address, I will send you a free set of Wilson Reaction tennis strain. It's a multifilament strain. It's a premium synthetic gut. It's a good set of strain. I usually use it in my crosses on my own racket. So it's a good set of strain. So the next three people who sign up and go and post why they love tennis on the forums, send me your address and your name, and I will send you a free set of strain. Don't even have to pay for shipping or anything. It's all yours. Secondly, before we get started today, I just wanted to comment briefly on just the incredible match yesterday between Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. Hopefully most of you out there who are listening to this had a chance to see at least part of that match. I was up the entire day watching it. I watched it from beginning to end without leaving the house and barely without leaving the couch. It was just such good tennis, and both those guys are just incredible champions. They're just, you know, very gracious, both of them, very humble, and yet two of the most talented tennis players to ever play the game. So to see them together on that stage, you know, such a prestigious event such as Wimbledon, and to see them both play such amazing tennis, and both put so much of themselves into that match, it was just an incredible thing to watch. It's matches like that that keep me motivated and keep me passionate about tennis. And I hope the rest of you guys got to see that as well. If not the whole match, at least the end. And I feel bad for Roger. He wanted that record so badly to win six in a row. So I definitely feel for him. And it would have been nice to see him accomplish that goal. But on the other hand, I'm definitely very happy for Rafael. He deserved that win. I think he played better than Roger throughout the whole course of the match. And it was just incredible to see him take that win. It was an amazing match. Okay, let's go ahead and get started on the content for today's Essential Tennis podcast. In a couple of minutes, I'm going to answer several great listener questions having to do with technique and the mental game and also strategy. But first, I would like to welcome back to the program Dr. Jack Kripsak. He's a sports medicine physician and works with all kinds of athletes, and he's going to answer two quick questions from Essential Tennis listeners before we get to my segment of the show. So welcome back to the show, Dr. Jack.
Well, thanks, Ian. It's great to be back. I really had a lot of fun doing the first show, and looking forward to answering some questions again this week.
All right, great. Well, let's go ahead and get started if you're ready.
Sure, let's go.
All right, our first question today is from Bruce in Florida. Bruce writes and says, Ian, thanks so much for the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm also a physician and found Dr. Jack's answers to be current, clear, and helpful. I have started the eccentric stretching with good results. I have much less pain and stiffness now. So that's great, Bruce, that you're already starting to see some results from Dr. Jack's suggestions. He has another question now. He says, my wife suffers from recurrent bouts of plantar fasciitis. Are there any similar stretches for her?
Okay, good question. And Bruce, thanks for sending in another question, and I'm glad that the eccentric stretches are helping you.
Yeah.
So for your wife, she can certainly do the ones that you're doing, which help, because with the plantar fascia along the bottom of the foot and then the Achilles coming up along the back of the heel creates somewhat of a pulley effect. So by keeping the Achilles nice and loose and flexible, that's going to help with the plantar fascia to a certain degree. The other interesting thing is that you talk about this being a chronic problem for your wife, and it would be noteworthy to see what kind of foot type she has and what kind of shoes she wears. Oftentimes we see female patients, especially in the summertime, wearing flat leather sandals or flip-flops or nice little leather sandals. And what happens is, since there's a lack of support on the arch of the foot, the arch starts to drop. There's a ligament in the instep of the foot called the spring ligament, and that helps create the archway. And now if that starts to flatten out, then the foot elongates, and that puts tension on the plantar fascia, which runs from the balls of the feet back to the heel.
Okay.
People used to call this a heel spur, because on x-ray you would see this long spike coming off the bottom of the heel. And actually that was just the tension from the plantar fascia pulling on the heel. So what you want to be able to do is stretch that out and maintain that archway from the spring ligament. So we have to address two issues here. Now, one other nice stretch, Bruce, that your wife can do is to have her rub the bottom of her foot over the top of a tennis ball and rock it back and forth. And she would rock from the balls of her feet just short of the point of the pain by the heel. So you don't want it to hurt. So you firmly want to roll that foot back and forth over the top of the tennis ball and press down a little bit. Now,
is that while standing or sitting? Or
sitting's fine. That's absolutely fine. And just put some pressure down with your leg so that there's pressure on the bottom of your foot, and it shouldn't hurt. It should be a nice stretch. And you can do that for a good 5 minutes. Make sure you do both feet to always keep a proper balance. Some people will recommend rolling your foot over a can of frozen orange juice or lemonade or something like that, pull it out of the freezer and roll it back. I kind of like the tennis balls better. I feel it has a little more of an apex to it, and you get a little better stretch. If you have some type of a plastic ball that you could fill with water and throw in the freezer, then you'd get a little ice in there to cool the hot plantar fascia down while you're stretching it, and that would be nice also. And there are some physical therapy companies that you can go online and try and find that from. So that's a really nice stretch.
Okay.
Some other things you can do is get a tension night splint. And there's one company called Dynasplint where you can get a special custom-made brace which keeps your foot bent at a 90-degree angle. And I think I talked about this last time with the Achilles tendon.
Yeah, I think you did.
Same thing. So you can go with that for the plantar fasciitis also. Or some of the companies have like a little sock that you put on your foot and you tie up around your calf, and it keeps your foot bent at a 90-degree angle while you're sleeping. You can try that also. If these things don't work, You can definitely see your physician about a treatment called iontophoresis, which is the electrical pulsation of a steroid like dexamethasone through an electric current, which doesn't burn. It may get a little warm, but there's a little steroid that goes through a jelly cell on your foot. An electric current drives it into the tissue, and it helps take the inflammation and swelling away in that plantar fascia where it attaches to the calcaneus or the heel. This is usually more useful in someone with an acute problem, and it works very nicely. And it's usually a treatment every other day for four treatments is about as much as you need. Anything more than 2 weeks, there's nothing in the medical literature that shows that it's of any added benefit. So up to 2 weeks would be the most that you'd want to do that.
Okay.
So the iontophoresis is a nice treatment. You would get that typically done in a physical therapy facility. The next is orthotics. And we like to use those custom FootMax orthotics because of the nice dynamic image that it gives. It's not just a static image. And certainly this can help support your arch, help support that sprained ligament and take some of the pressure off the plantar fascia. And even in the back of the heel, they can make a little donut to take some of the pressure off the heel. Those work very, very nicely. Another option, which is a little it's a little more radical and it's not typically covered by insurance, is shockwave therapy, which is similar. It's basically the same principles when you have a kidney stone and you have the kidney stone shocked with an with a ultrasound current and it pulverizes the kidney stone and then you pass it. Well, what we do here with the plantar fascia is it shockwaves the attachment and it causes inflammation, bleeding, and then the cells regenerate and stimulate, similar to the prolotherapy that I discussed last time. And again, prolotherapy would be another treatment with the injection of a sugar water solution into the spring ligament and into the attachment of the plantar fascia to the calcaneus. And that works very nicely also. And that would, if you can find a good prolotherapist in your area, that's a great treatment, especially if you look to address both issues. The shockwave therapy can be about $1,000. It's not covered by insurance. And the shockwave therapy does not typically address the spring ligament anyhow. It's usually just going after the plantar fascia's attachment to the calcaneus. So there are certainly a bunch of options and things that you can do to address this. Definitely, Bruce, first have your wife start off with the eccentric stretches and rolling your foot over the tennis ball to get started. And make sure that she's wearing nice sneakers and shoes that have a good supportive arch in them. And then if that doesn't work, then you can progress on to the other more aggressive treatments.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks for the advice there, Dr. Jack. And
sure.
I like how you organize those options as well, kind of from simplest, things that you can do at home and then on through kind of more advanced medical options. So hopefully one of the at-home things works well for you, Bruce. And if not, if you have any further questions, let me know and I'll definitely relay those over to Dr. Jack.
Sure. And Bruce, I'm signed up on Ian's tennis community. So if you need to shoot me an email, I'm on there now and you can get a hold of me also.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Jack, I was really happy to see you sign up for the forums there. I was excited to see you posting.
Sure. And I'd love to get questions and maybe there's some things that we can address on the podcast, which would be great. And Bruce, shoot me an email. I'd love to hear from you. I did my residency down in Clearwater, Florida. I'd love to know in Florida where you are, Florida, or what kind of physician you are. So please feel free to shoot me an email from Ian's website.
All right. Well, Bruce, hopefully that's helpful to you. If you need any further help, let me know, or you can contact Jack through the forum at essentialtennis.com as well. All right. Well, let's get on to our second question. And we only have two today. It'll be a little bit shorter. This question is from Ahmed. He writes and says, what are some exercises you can do at home, just in the backyard, to keep your tennis skills sharp while you are away from the court for an extended period of time? Lately, family duties have taken most of my time, and if I can get to the court once a week, I'm pretty lucky. Ahmed.
Oh, Ahmed, I'm feeling your pain. My wife, three little kids. I hear you. There's always something going on, always a soccer practice to go to or a ballet practice, and my own work and time becomes scarce and is a real premium on free time and time to take care of ourselves. So I really appreciate where you're coming from with this question. So let's get after some things that you can do at home. First, yeah. As I discussed last week in the podcast, get a physio ball. The core strengthening is so important. You don't want to lose that. The core stability helps everything else function, and when you maintain that, it's going to be easier to get back on the court because now you're going to have a good foundation. So you can go out and get those at a sporting goods store, or geez, they sell them in some of the supermarkets by me, or the kind of Costco and BJ places that package things up with a book and a video at a really great price. So look into getting yourself a physio ball for core strengthening. Next would be jumping rope. This is a great exercise to do, definitely easy to do at home, doesn't take a whole heck of a lot of time or space, and all you need is a rope, and you can pick those up anywhere. If you've got kids, I'm sure one of them has a jump rope you can use. It's great for cardiovascular conditioning, and it's great for footwork, and Ian, you know how essential good footwork is on the tennis court.
Absolutely.
I've jumped
a lot of rope in my time, that's for sure. It's definitely a great workout.
Yeah, it keeps those calves nice and strong to stay light on your feet, so to be able to bounce back and forth, you know, when someone's running a little cross court, or be able to get that acceleration to the net on an approach shot or for a net shot. So jumping rope is really, really great.
Would you suggest more quicker spurts and a higher intensity or a longer duration of time for that?
Oh, I think you need to do a little interval training, a little bit of both, because you want to maintain the cardiovascular conditioning, but certainly some little quick work is good for agility and for speed and for quickness, especially, to get off the ball, to keep those feet moving quick. So quick reaction and also endurance for your cardiovascular conditioning. So I think mixing up a little bit of both is excellent. Depending on what you want to do, mix it up in that day, or do one day quick work, one day long work, whatever, but doing a little bit of both is always excellent. And there are studies that show that if you get into a routine, a monotonous routine of your training, that you hit a plateau and don't progress. But as you create a variety in your workout by doing different things, especially between strength conditioning and speed conditioning and agility conditioning, that you actually help perpetuate your physical condition and athletic performance. You never want to fail. You always want to keep a variety to your training. Next, Ahmed, and for all the other listeners, a great website that you can go to is ASMI.org, and this stands for American Sports Medicine Institute.org. Don't go to .com. You'll end up going to a Japanese shipping line and seeing a bunch of oil tankers, so make sure it's .org.
Good to know.
Yeah. Now, on the bottom of the page, there's going to be a little search box. Type into that search box, throwers 10, like a baseball thrower or a pitcher, throwers. T-H-R-O-W-E-R-S space T-E-N. And search for that website, not the World Wide Web. And that will take you to a next page. And the top two listings give you a listing of all the exercises with pictures, and then the second one gives you a video clip of all the exercises to do with the proper form. And these are they're great for the shoulder, they're great for your forearms, your wrists, and all you need for this is some exercise tubing, some TheraBand, some tubing that you could get at the sporting goods store, so you don't need weights for these. All you need is some resistance tubing, which is very inexpensive and easy to keep around the house. You don't have to lug it. You don't have to worry about anybody, dropping a weight on their foot. So it's really, really good. These are excellent exercises. They help keep the rotator cuff muscles in proper balance so that when you do get back out there and play, you're not going to say, oh, my shoulder's killing me the next day, or I'm getting some pain in my forearm, or my hand's a little tight. So those are really, really excellent exercises to do, because so often I see patients come in with what we call an impingement syndrome, where they have shoulder pain because their rotator cuff muscles are not in proper alignment and balance. And these are great exercises to fix that. It's so much better to do these exercises so that you don't have to get a steroid shot or someone tell you need surgery. You just do these and you help prevent that.
Yeah, definitely.
Take a tennis ball and bounce it back and forth against the wall quickly. Build up your eye-hand coordination, which is really, really good. Ian, you told me this one, get some balls, get a juggling kit and practice some juggling around the house.
Again, yeah, definitely.
That's a great one, Ian. Eye-hand coordination, excellent. which is very good. And my new favorite, if any of your kids or you have a Nintendo DS, one of those little home video games, there's a great program called Flash Focus. I think it's $39.95, and it's a sports vision training game. It takes less than 10 minutes to train every day, and in fact, if you try to train more than 20 minutes a day, it shuts down on you, so you can't overtrain.
Really?
It's really great. I've been doing it now for 3 months, and Ian, I swear, I'm seeing the ball so much better on the court.
Yeah,
As I'm seeing it, I had a very bad habit of taking my eye off the ball, and I see the ball so much better as it's hitting the strings. It's really,
right.
really improved the accuracy of my shots. My wife's doing it, but she needs to work on her footwork a little more.
I won't tell her you said that.
But she says it's helping her. And, you know, I have really found this to be a valuable tool. It's easy to use, something you do at home. You can do on the plane on a business trip, five-minute office break at lunch, lunchtime, whatever. So I think those are some really cool things that you can do around the house. You're not going to need very much equipment. And what equipment you would get besides the DS, which is, I guess, $120. I mean, but if you didn't get that and all the other stuff, it probably cost you less than $50. And your kids may have a lot of that stuff around the house anyhow. So it's really an inexpensive way to go to get some great home exercise stuff going to stay in good tennis shape.
Great. All right. Well, thanks a lot for the suggestions, Jack. And yeah, you're right. So many of those were inexpensive stuff you can do at home, and yet very relevant and in the long run, definitely, I think will be very helpful. So that's great advice. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm always welcome to get more questions. I'm having a ball with this, and I hope everyone's benefiting from some of these suggestions. This is a lot of fun for me.
Yeah. I got a lot of great feedback on the first podcast that I had you on. So I'll definitely continue to have you on. And everybody, if you have any sports medicine type questions, whether it's about injuries or injury prevention or maybe workout and fitness, anything along those lines, definitely let me know. Or I'm going to put up a forum on the Essential Tennis boards as well. You can head on over there and post your questions there. And we'll probably have Dr. Jack back again in probably, 2 weeks or so, another 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, that is, if you'll come back on, Dr. Jack, how does that sound?
Oh, that sounds great, Ian. All I need is a phone call or a little email, and I'm good to go.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and hopefully Ahmed and Bruce, those of you who asked questions, hopefully that was helpful to you, and everybody else listening as well. It's great information. And I look forward to hearing back from anybody that might have helped. So, Jack, thank you again, and I look forward to having you back on in the future.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks again, and good luck with the rest of the podcast.
Thanks very much. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the next part of the show. Our first question today comes from Dean. He writes and says, "Hello, Ian. I have a question for your podcast. I participate in a couple USTA leagues and have been watching how our best doubles opponents position themselves during a point. They do typically approach the net, but actually position themselves closer to the service line. One will be a step or so in front of the service line, while the other will be slightly behind the service line. Could you comment on the merits and/or drawbacks of this formation during doubles play? Many thanks for the advice and instruction you provide on the online tennis community. Looking forward to your response, Dean." All right, Dean, well, that's a great question. And this is a big topic and something that isn't really cut and dry. There are general things that are better than others, and that's kind of what I'm going to talk about. The first thing I'd like to say in response to your question is smart doubles positioning is very situational. One position is not always going to work 100% of the time. In fact, no position is going to work 100% of the time, obviously. But it's good to be good at different positions with your partner, depending on what your opponent is good at. Now, in general, the best general positioning strategy in doubles is get close to the net as soon as possible. That's a general strategy that I always follow when I play myself, and it's a general strategy that I always teach. I always want my students to be good and comfortable at closing into the net immediately as soon as a doubles point starts. And I've, throughout the different podcasts that I've already recorded, I've talked a lot about that. It's so important to be comfortable if you want to be a good doubles player, moving forwards and closing into the net and pressuring your opponents. That's absolutely essential if you ever want to be a high-level doubles player. Now, beyond the general positioning strategy of getting close to the net as soon as possible, you have to be able to adjust for your opponent's strengths and also their tendencies. Meaning, some people that you play are going to have great ground strokes. They might play one up, one back. The back player is going to have big ground strokes, and he's just going to try to attack. He's just going to blast the ball at you and your partner over and over. If any of you saw the Williams sisters play their doubles final, that's basically the style of doubles that they play. They play one up, one back for the most part, and whoever happens to be back just crushes the heck out of her ground strokes, and the person up at the net kind of plays cleanup. So you're going to play some people that are good at that style. You're going to play some opponents that both players are going to move up quickly, and they're going to try to take over the net. They're going to try to intimidate you, and they're going to try to finish the points as quickly as possible by moving in and putting the ball away. And lastly, you're going to play opponents that are good defenders. They're going to stay back, maybe one up, one back, or maybe even both back, and just play a lot of defensive type shots. They're going to lob a lot. They're not going to give you a lot of pace. And they're going to kind of keep you off balance and try to keep you pushed away from the net and keep you uncomfortable. And there's all kinds of different combinations of those three different main types of strategies that your opponents could play. Your job as a good doubles player is to notice those tendencies and notice what they're good at and then formulate your own strategy around that. So having said all that, these two guys that you're watching, these opponents that you say are the best in your league, they've got a pretty good position going on. You say that they usually do move in right away, so that's great. That forces their opponents to be pressured and to try to hit good shots, try to hit passing shots, or try to hit perfect lobs to try to beat them. So by moving in right away, that's good. They're pressuring their opponents. By being one a little closer and one a little farther away, that would indicate that they're looking a lot of times to be lobbed. And so one player is a little bit farther back just in case they get lobbed so that he's in a little bit better position to go back and cover a good defensive shot by their opponents. So this is a pretty good position they're playing. They're being aggressive by moving forwards, but they're still being somewhat defensive by having one player a little bit farther back. And so they're kind of in position to do either one, either attack or go back for the defensive shot. Now, if I was playing those guys, if they were my opponents, my strategy would be to move in as quickly as possible and try to beat them up to the net, in which case it's possible I could just put the ball away outright as soon as I get up there. But on my way up, I'd be looking to keep the ball to the person who's a little bit farther back until I was in a position to attack. The one player who's keeping himself farther away is putting himself in a dangerous position because myself coming in, I'm looking for who's farthest away from me. And on my way into the net, I'm going to keep the ball at the feet of that player because he's giving me more space to hit at his feet. My goal as a good doubles player is to move forwards and keep the ball low to my opponents so that they hit up to me and I have a chance to put the ball away. So this person who's hanging back a little bit, I'm going to be just dropping the ball low at his feet over and over on my way into the net. And then as soon as he pops the ball up, I'm going to hammer the ball at his partner who's close to me. And I'm going to put that ball away at his partner because his partner doesn't have as much time to react once I do have a chance to attack. So that would be my general strategy in playing these guys. If you don't have the touch to keep the ball short and low to the person who's farther away, if you pop the ball up, it sounds like either of these guys is probably good enough to move forwards and finish the point. So what you have to be able to do is control the ball well enough to keep it low to the person who's farther away, and then have the quickness and the footwork to move in, take the ball that they pop up eventually, and put it away forcefully at the person who's closer to you. So there's a brief overview there, Dean, the merits and also the drawbacks of how they're positioning themselves. They're doing a good job, but against people who are as good or even better than them, that person who's hanging back is going to be a little bit of a liability. I don't know what their strengths are beyond their positioning, so it's hard to say exactly how they would get beat, but there's a good general outline for you. Hopefully that answers your question, Dean. If I can help you any more, let me know. And let me know what you think of that answer. Okay, our next question today comes from Ahmed, and he has a good question here, and it's a question that a lot of big, higher-up people in tennis are asking themselves. It has to do with the popularity of tennis. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I think it's an interesting question, and I'll be happy to give my opinion. Ahmed says, what is your opinion as to why the sport of tennis is so down compared to others, coming up like NASCAR, in terms of playing popularity and TV coverage? Well, here's my take on that, Ahmed. First of all, when you take your more popular sports in America, and also in the world, depending on which of these you're talking about, baseball, football, basketball, and also soccer, those are kind of the big ones in terms of America and also the world abroad. The reason why I think those in general tend to be a little more popular is because, first of all, you don't need any special equipment. Basketball, all you need is the ball, and pretty much any public park in America is going to have a basketball court. So it's not something where you need some kind of exclusive membership or any membership at all, for that matter. There's hundreds of thousands, probably millions of basketball hoops throughout the country, and it's just an easy sport to just pick up and just play. Football, same kind of thing. If you're like me, growing up, you played a lot of football just in the backyard or at the park with just the neighborhood kids, and same deal. You don't need any special equipment. All you need is a football and just a stretch of grass or even dirt is fine, and you can play just about anywhere. Baseball, same kind of thing. Baseball is another sport that I spent a lot of time playing just in the backyard or out in the street, also at the park. And you don't even need really a baseball diamond. You can play just about anywhere. And also soccer. All you need is a soccer ball. And no real special skills or equipment besides that. Can set up goals with, you know, a tree and a shoe, and you got yourself a goal. Tennis is a little bit different from those main sports, in that, I mean, you need a court to play. Yes, you could play mini tennis, you know, in the driveway and kind of tap the ball back and forth, but it's just not the same thing. Obviously, you kind of need a court in order to play tennis, or at least to fully experience it. And the number of courts, public courts in America, depending on where you live, it's just not nearly as much. You can't just play in your backyard. And even if you're close to a park might not even have courts. And if they do, they may be, you know, poorly maintained. I see lots of courts that are just deteriorated and really almost unplayable between the nets and the court. So just in terms of equipment, tennis, if you don't grow up in a nicer community, you might not have access to tennis courts and equipment at all. If you're in an upper class type community, it's very possible you are a member of a club, and you get the chance to play at nice courts, and you get to have a nice racket, and that sort of thing. And so you get exposed to it, and then you can have some appreciation and continue to follow it as you go through life. But if you don't grow up around it and being exposed to it and having the chance to play and appreciate it, it's just not the same as baseball or football or basketball or even soccer, where you can just meet with the guys, go to the backyard or out to the street or whatever, and just play. It's just not the same thing. So that's part of the reason why I don't think tennis in general is as popular, or at least is perceived to be as popular, as those main sports. Now, when it comes to NASCAR, NASCAR is different from those other sports. Obviously, you do need special equipment to be driving a race car. So it's not the same kind of situation as it is with basketball or baseball. But what NASCAR does have is an excitement and a danger about it. And it's an intense sport. And NASCAR and racing in general is actually something that I can appreciate more or less firsthand. I have driven on racetracks before, and it's something that I enjoy, and racing in general is something that I'm an enthusiast of. And I've experienced it personally, not in an actual race car yet, but it's something that I can appreciate firsthand. That being said, even if you don't have firsthand experience driving on a racetrack, it's very easy to appreciate what they're doing. Just the speed and the danger and the skill that it takes to do what they're doing, you can appreciate that very easily. And it's the same kind of thing with boxing or ultimate fighting, those kind of sports where there's danger involved. And even though people might not appreciate it from the standpoint of having done it, they can appreciate it simply by watching and understanding the dedication and the skill and the danger that's involved. And so it's entertaining for that reason. So tennis doesn't really have either of those things going for it. First of all, you can't play it anywhere. You do need special equipment and you need special skills. Not to enjoy, period. You don't have to be incredibly talented in terms of technique just to enjoy it. You can have bad technique and enjoy tennis a great deal. But there's not courts everywhere, and not everybody has access to the equipment needed to enjoy it. And so from that standpoint, not as many people can appreciate watching it on TV. They don't understand what's going on because they haven't experienced it personally. And then on the other end of the scale, there's not really any danger involved, such as in racing or boxing or any other kind of martial arts or fighting. And so it's kind of in between those two extremes. And I think that's why there's a perception that it's not as popular. It is popular worldwide, and it's not that it's a fringe sport and not many people enjoy it. But on the other hand, in America, for example, it's definitely not as popular as some of the mainstream sports. So, Ahmed, those are my thoughts on that. Hopefully that was relevant and you guys found that interesting. And I actually spent a good amount of time thinking about that. But that's my take. Thanks for the question, Ahmed, and hopefully that answered your question.
The Essential Tennis Podcast is brought to you by
Bridgewater Medical Group. Is a multi-specialty medical group located in Bridgewater, New Jersey, and is your home for primary care, gastroenterology, sports medicine, and general internal medicine. They offer a broad array of on-site, state-of-the-art services to make your healthcare experience more pleasurable. Scheduled appointments are preferred, but physician assistants are available for walk-in care. For more information, call Bridgewater Medical Group at 908-722-0808.
For more information on sponsors of the Essential Tennis Podcast or to become a sponsor, visit www.essentialtennis.com. And now, back to the show.
Okay, next up are a couple of good questions from Mike in New Jersey. Mike is a 3.0 player. He writes and says, I have a question about playing a certain type of pusher. This guy I practice with likes to hit moon balls with plenty of topspin and almost always down the middle of the court. I can return his shots with some decent pace and clearance, but his style of play wears me down both mentally and physically, and after a few rallies, I try to go for too much and usually end up hitting unforced errors. There's another part to his question as well that I'll answer in a second. Well, Mike, the topic you bring up is very, very common, and especially among players at your level, about a 2.5 to 3.5 level, or even really up to a 4.0 level. This is the type of player that recreational level people have the most trouble beating. And they're tough to beat because they miss very rarely. They're good at what they do. They put a lot of balls in play, and usually without very much pace. They don't really give you anything to work with in terms of speed. So you have to have pretty good technique to beat this type of player, either good technique or good patience. Now, there's two ways you can improve to beat this opponent. First of all, and you mentioned this in your email, that you have mental difficulty, you lose your concentration. The first part of your game that you can improve if you want to beat this player is to increase your mental focus. There's a phrase that I first heard at my first teaching job several years ago. The director of tennis there, I remember, used a phrase that he, I'm not sure if he came up with it, I'm sure he didn't, but he used the phrase shot tolerance. Everybody has a certain number of shots that they're comfortable hitting before they kind of crack, and mentally they lose their focus and they just can't continue to hit the ball and play over and over past a certain number of shots. And that comes down to mental focus. So the first way you can improve is by increasing the number of shots you're willing to hit in a point, increasing your mental focus to be able to hit more shots in play over and over and over. Don't be surprised when you have to hit extra shots against this player. You know that it's coming. The way that you're going to increase that that focus is through practice and repetition. You need to practice hitting a certain shot. Let's say your forehand cross court, and practice hitting it 10 times in a row cross court, and don't stop rallying cross court until you've made 10 in a row. And then go to your backhand, hit 10 backhands in a row cross court in the singles court, and then when you get to a point, you know you're mentally built up and you're conditioned to be able to hit that many shots in a row in the court. You probably don't have many 20 ball rallies during points. They might be close to that, some of them, but if you go out there with the confidence knowing that you can hit 10 in a row cross court from either side, forehand or backhand, that's going to go a long way in being able to beat this person. Secondly, you need to increase your ability to be aggressive consistently, and that's going to allow you to shorten the points. So to build your level of tennis, you need to not only increase your mental focus, but you need to also build your ability, your technique, and your physical ability to hit the ball more strongly so that you can shorten points against this guy. Because I don't want you to always be stuck with just being satisfied, just putting the ball back in play. Hitting the ball back in play is great, but my goal for you is to eventually be able to do it with force and be able to force your opponent to hit you shorter shots that you can continue to attack on and put the ball away and be confident and win points based on good shots and not just rely on just putting the ball back in the court, which is basically what he's doing. So you have to increase your ability to be aggressive, and not just aggressive. Notice I said be aggressive consistently. And this is going to come back again to repetition and practice. And if you don't have the technique ability right now to hit the ball aggressively and to do it 3, 4, 5 times in a row from either side, then you have to learn how to swing correctly to be able to do that. So that's the answer to your question. You need to build your mental focus, your shot tolerance, so that you can hit more shots in play in general without losing your focus and your concentration and breaking down mentally. And you have to increase your ability to be aggressive and to do that consistently without making lots of errors along the way. And there's no easy way around this. Those are the two things you have to improve if you want to beat a pusher, period. So those are the two main skills you're going to have to develop in your game. If you have more specific questions on either of those, let me know. I could certainly go more in depth on both those. Now, he has a second question as well. He says, also, I end up stuck behind the baseline during the point and can't finish the point effectively. What strategy should I use against someone like this? Thanks, Mike. Well, Mike, again, there's two things that you can do to break out of that pattern as well. First of all, this goes back to the first question that I answered for you. You need to learn to hit stronger with more depth. You need to learn how to hit the ball deeper in your opponent's side and to hit it with more aggression, a stronger shot deep in his side to force him to hit shorter to you. You have to kind of get on top of him before he gets on top of you. If you just sit back there behind the baseline and just get everything back in play, sounds like he's pretty good at keeping the ball deep in the court, and he's forcing you to stay back well behind the baseline where it is difficult to attack. You have to try to hit the ball deeply to him, return the favor. He's not going to like that. If you give him the same type of shot that he's giving to you, eventually he will break down. Eventually he's going to give you a short shot. And then once he does, don't just put it back in play. You have to attack again. Otherwise, he's going to fall right back into his rhythm of doing what he likes. And that's exactly what we don't want. We want to make him uncomfortable. So the first thing you need to do, and this will fix both of your questions, is learn how to hit the ball more strongly and deep in the court. If your ground strokes aren't consistently landing past the service line, they're not strong enough. You should be hitting most your ground strokes past the service line and deep in the court, unless there's some specific reason why you're hitting short, trying to hit a drop shot or maybe a short angled shot. Most of your ground strokes should be deep in the court. Now, a second thing that you can improve in order to defend against your opponent hitting deep to you is to learn how to take the ball on the rise. And that means making contact while the ball is on its way up from the bounce. The easiest time to make contact with a ground stroke is when the ball is on its way down from the bounce. So the ball has been struck by your opponent, it comes over to your side of the court, bounces, comes up, starts dropping back down again. The time when it's easiest to hit a ground stroke is when the ball is coming back down again after it's bounced. So it's gone up to the top of its bounce, started to drop again, and then at waist height is an ideal spot to make contact. And on its way down from the bounce is the easiest time to make contact. It gives you the most amount of time to set up and get prepared to make your swing. However, if your opponent is good at hitting the ball deep over and over and over, moving in farther and taking the ball right after it bounces is a way to defend against that. So you can practice that with a partner, taking the ball right off the bounce. You should still be trying to make contact around your waist where it's most comfortable, and the timing is more difficult. This is a higher level shot than what you're used to hitting, so it's going to take some practice, but you can do it. The difficult part is learning the timing of your swing. You're not used to taking the ball so early right after it bounces. So there's the answer to your questions, Mike. Hopefully that's clear to you and it makes sense. If I can help you any more with any of these things or anything else, definitely let me know. Thanks for taking the time to write your question. Okay, two more questions to answer today, and I've saved these for last on purpose. Once again, I have some mental tennis questions, which are often my favorite to answer. These both come from Amy in Massachusetts. Amy, before I get going on answering your questions, you need to send me an email. The email address that you left me in the form when you used the form on my website is incorrect. I tried responding to you a couple of different times, and I keep getting my emails bounced back. So the email address you gave me is not correct. That's why I never responded to your email. So please send me an email, and I'll respond to the question you had about strains, and I'll be happy to send you a set of strain. Amy left me a review on iTunes Music Store a couple weeks ago. I had an offer where I was giving away free sets of strain for leaving me a comment on the iTunes Store. So Amy, send me another email. Just send me an email directly to ian@essentialtennis.com, and I'll get you set up with a free set of strain as soon as you contact me. All right, let's go ahead and get to Amy's questions. Her first question is, Ian, I love the podcast. It's so helpful. I especially love this stuff on the mental game. It's my biggest handicap. I think I may have the nuttiest question you've ever fielded, but I am completely serious. I know you've discussed the warm-up, but I have a mental question about the warm-up. I play a lot of doubles on several different teams. I am a smart, competitive, and consistent player, but one of my biggest challenges is feeding balls in the warm-up. I tend to misfeed overheads, send ground strokes to the cross-court player, the person I'm not warming up with, etc. It is embarrassing and sets me off on the wrong mental footing, not to mention the guilt of feeling that I haven't gotten my opponent an adequate warm-up. Any suggestions beyond going out to practice warming up? Well, Amy, that's a good question. And the first thing you need to understand, and listen to me carefully, no, you're not the only person who deals with this. You think you're crazy, and you feel badly about this, and you think this is a crazy off-the-wall question. It's absolutely not. You would not believe how many people that are listening to this podcast are saying right now, sitting in their car or going for a walk listening to this, so many people are saying, oh yeah, that's definitely me. I have the same problem. Maybe it might not be exactly to the extent you're describing, but I myself, I have problems with this. I don't play much. Recently, I teach a lot, and so I don't always have the time to get out and play competitive doubles myself. But I can tell you the last time I played doubles, which was about 2, maybe 3 weeks ago, I had this exact same problem. I hadn't played in quite a while. I was feeling a little bit tight, not very confident because I hadn't really taken a big swing at any shot in a couple weeks. And so I was a little bit tentative and a little bit nervous getting out there to play. And I guarantee you I had this exact same problem. So you are not the only person. Now, let me get back to actually answering your question. But again, the first thing you need to understand is this is not a unique problem. A lot of people face this. So don't worry about it. It's not something that you have to be ashamed of. My number one suggestion is what you mentioned in your question is just practice and repetition. Although rereading your question, it sounds clear that you play a lot of tennis. So maybe that's something we need to get past. But for those of you listening, the more matches you play, the more comfortable you're going to get doing a warm-up. And there is some pressure involved there because you're expected to be able to hit the ball back to your opponent cooperatively so that you can both get a good warm-up in and get a lot of repetition in before your match. So there's some pressure there to be able to hit under control and hit it back again and again and again. So it's definitely understandable. The more you play, the easier this should get. However, if it's not, if it's still not easy for you, and Amy, obviously you're still having problems, I have some more things here as well that you need to understand. firstly, Amy, it's important to understand, and this kind of goes back to the first point that I just made. It's important to understand that when you go out there to warm up, there's three other players there, and you're not the only one who's feeling some nerves. I guarantee you the other three players are feeling some pressure too. Everybody there is trying to cooperate and get the warm up in. And I promise you, you're not the only one. Don't isolate yourself into thinking that you're crazy and you're the only person who has this problem. You're kind of setting yourself up there for even more pressure by isolating yourself mentally and thinking, oh man, I'm having so much trouble with this, and the other people on the other side of the net must think I'm no good, and what's my partner thinking? She's probably thinking, oh great, I've got to play with this person. And mentally, you're putting yourself out, you know, over in the corner by yourself and putting all this pressure on yourself to have to do it perfectly. And in your own mind, you're setting yourself up for failure because you're putting all of this heavy pressure on yourself to have to be perfect during the warm-up. And it's compounding on top of itself, because every time you miss, you feel worse and worse, and you have this thought in your mind that you're the only person dealing with it. And so you've just really made it hard on yourself to go out and warm up and just be relaxed. You've made it almost impossible to be relaxed because you've isolated yourself by saying or by thinking you're the only person who deals with this. And then when you go out to warm up and you already have those preconceived notions that that you're the only one who's nervous out there out of the four players, and then when you do miss, that adds more and more pressure on yourself. And the more pressure you have, the tighter you're going to get, and the tighter you get, the more you're going to miss. And so it's just compounding on top of itself, and it all goes back to you thinking that you must be the only person who feels some pressure during the warm-up. So the first thing you need to get rid of is that thought that you're the only person who feels any pressure at all to hit the ball back to their opponent. You're not. And beyond that, you need to understand one other main thing, and that's that missing is part of the game. And everybody listening needs to hear that again. Listen carefully. It's okay to miss. Missing is part of playing tennis, period. You will miss. Did you hear me? You're going to miss. Don't worry about it. You're out there trying to have fun and play a sport that you enjoy, and you're going to make mistakes. That's part of it. In fact, I don't remember if it was last week's podcast or the podcast before. I think it was last week, where I was talking about the number of mistakes people typically make. In the vast majority of tennis, all levels, up through professional players, most matches have more errors than winning shots. So if you're a recreational player, 90% of your matches, probably more than that, really, through the long run, most of your matches are going to have more errors in them than winning shots, than winners hit. And that's just the reality of tennis. It's a difficult sport. And so don't think that by missing, you're now not worthy of being out there and you shouldn't be warming up with these players because you're not good enough. It's all part of the game. Missing's part of it. Don't worry about it and put pressure on yourself to have to make every shot. If you hit a shot over to the wrong person, don't worry about it. That's fine. You know, put your hand up, say, sorry, you know, I didn't mean to do that. But don't let it bother you past that. You're putting too much pressure on yourself to try to hit every shot perfectly. And then you're compounding that that pressure by thinking that nobody else deals with this problem. So hopefully that answers your question, Amy. And I really want you to do better, and I want you to get over this and feel more comfortable. And you can. It just starts with understanding the truths and the realities of tennis. You're not alone, and it's okay to miss. So there really shouldn't be any pressure. And if you're feeling pressure, you're putting it on yourself. It's not the other people putting it on you. You need to relax and just kind of realize what's going on around you and realize the truths of tennis. All right, we have one more question to answer here, also from Amy, before we wrap up today. Also a mental tennis-related question. She says, on a related mental issue, the tennis world in these parts is pretty small. Many times we play people we know or have heard about, and when we go on the court, we know too much about the players, who they've beaten, etc. It's easier to play strangers. I love your idea about just playing the ball, but beyond that, any other tips? Many thanks for making this podcast happen, Amy. Well, yes, Amy, this is another area in which you're putting pressure upon yourself. And there's some things that you need to think about and make decisions about in order to take care of this. First of all, understand that knowing your opponent should be a huge benefit. It should not be a detriment to you. Knowing your opponent and knowing their strengths and their weaknesses, that should be a benefit to your game. You should be able to come up with some kind of strategy beforehand, whereas playing a stranger, you don't know their strengths and their weaknesses until you start playing, and so you have to kind of set up your game plan as you go. So in general, knowing your opponent should be a benefit. You're taking that knowledge and saying, all right, I know this person, I know what they're good at, and you're adding pressure to yourself using that. You're saying, oh crap, I know this person, I know what they're doing, I know what their strengths are, so therefore I should probably be winning this match. And by thinking that ahead of time, again, you're setting yourself up for pressure, undue pressure. And the question you need to ask yourself is, why are you playing and who are you playing for? Are you playing because you want to please your teammates on your team and you want to please your partner that you're playing with by winning? Are you playing because you want to make them happy? Or are you playing because you want to enjoy yourself? You want to enjoy life and get out there and play a sport, something that you enjoy, something that's pleasurable and recreational, and it's a good workout, and it's something that you enjoy. And so you're out there for yourself. And not saying that in a selfish way, but you need to ask yourself, why are you out there? By playing for your teammates or for your partner, that adds pressure that's not necessary and pressure that you don't need. You should be out there playing for yourself, for your own enjoyment of the game, to have fun and to compete also. But anything beyond that is going to add pressure. And it sounds like you're pressuring yourself to have to win these matches when you know your opponents. Secondly, the question that I would want you to ask yourself is, are you scared to lose? It sounds like that could be an issue here, because you're going into the match knowing your opponents. And so in the back of your head, you're thinking, oh, crap, what if I go in knowing these people? They've beaten so-and-so, or, you know, this team beat them, and so we should be able to beat them too. And you're putting these preconceived notions on the match before you even start, either about the person specifically or the team as a whole, and you're pressuring yourself into having to win the match. The converse of that is you're making yourself scared to lose the match by building it up before you even step on the court. You're putting fear in the back of your head to lose, and that's getting you tight. It's getting you nervous, and so when you go out, you can't perform at your best. And here's what you need to understand about that. And this kind of goes back to missing. It's okay to miss. And it's okay to lose. You're going to lose. Everybody loses. And that's just part of sports. That's just part of playing a sport. You're going to lose matches. And, you know, I understand. I want to win every time I play. And it's difficult for me to deal with that sometimes, because I'm a perfectionist by nature. I talked about this a couple weeks ago. I understand that it's hard. It's hard sometimes to lose, but you have to put it in perspective. You're out there playing something that should be enjoyable, and it's a recreational sport. Losing is part of it. Two teams are going to go out there, and one team has to lose. And on that particular day, everything might not line up for you. You might not play your best, and that's fine. Your partner not play her best, and that's fine. You're not always going to play your best, and in fact, you rarely will. You might go out and play your best and get beat anyway. Your opponents might just be so good that you just don't have a chance to win that day because they were better than you, and that's going to happen. It doesn't mean you're any less of a person or even any less of a tennis player, because every tennis player loses. So don't worry about it. It's something that you are adding pressure to yourself with, and it occurs from setting it up beforehand. You're putting these preconceived notions in your head that by knowing these players, you should be beating them. And then you're also putting in your head that losing must be bad. And certainly, you know, we're going out there to try to win. It's not that you're trying to lose. I know that you want to win the match, and that's perfectly fine. But you have to have a healthy understanding of competition. You're going to lose sometimes. And it's just part of life. You don't always win in life, and it's important to have a good perspective on what you're doing, why you're doing it, be able to accept whatever outcome happens. Just because you try hard doesn't mean you always get what you want. It doesn't mean that you always win. And this is part of why I enjoy teaching. Why I enjoy teaching a sport. Because these are life lessons. When I teach kids stuff like this, I get to teach them how to approach life. You don't always get your way. And you have to understand that when you don't, it's important to have a healthy balance there. You know, getting angry and crying and stomping your foot doesn't make it any better. And so it's important to understand you're going to lose sometimes. And there's no sense in pressuring yourself to have to win. Well, Amy, I covered a lot of ground there in hopes that hopefully a handful of things that I said really kind of struck home and made a lot of sense to you. And right away, you know, you knew, all right, this is what I really need to work on. So hopefully something in there made sense and is helpful to you. I have a book for sale on my website by Vic Braden, who is a sports psychologist and a tennis coach. It's called Mental Tennis, and I highly, highly recommend it to everybody listening, and especially if you have mental issues. It's an incredible book. It's helped me a lot in my tennis. Mental problems are something I've struggled with a lot, and it's been a big help to me. So Amy, check that out, and I definitely recommend picking that up. Amy, hopefully that was helpful to you. I look forward to hearing back from you. Let me know if it was, and if I can help you any further, let me know. And also make sure to send me an email using your email address so that I get the correct one, and I'll be happy to send you a free set of Strain as well. Okay, well, that does it for episode 14 of the Essential Tennis Podcast. Just to let you guys know, I'm going to be out of town on vacation. I'm going to see some family and also see a wedding on my wife's side. So I'm going to be out of town all of next week, and I won't be able to do a podcast on the 14th, unfortunately, of July. So I apologize for that. If there was any way I could have worked it out, I would. But no podcast on the 14th, so I will see you guys again on the 21st. That's when I'm going to release the next podcast. In the meantime, head on over to EssentialTennis.com. Sign up for the forums. If you want a free set of Strain, post a new topic under Why Do You Love Tennis? I want to see why you love tennis. Tell me about it and tell everybody else in the community. We'll get some good topic discussion going there. And also, make sure to send your questions in the meantime. If you have questions for myself, about your mental game or about technique or strategy or equipment, let me know. Send me an email through the website or directly at ian@essentialtennis.com. All right, well, that's all for today, everybody. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate you listening, and I appreciate you downloading the podcast. Thank you very much for your support. It's because of the listeners that this show is possible. So thank you very much. Take care this week and next week, and good luck with your tennis.